One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Cloud 259 Running on Air. I'm Greg Lemelstein. As always, I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones. It's Friday the 13th, Friday, April 13th, and this is episode 63. And time flies. We're in the thick of spring marathon season. We've got Paris, Rotterdam, Gold Coast, Australia, Boston, London. Bren, it's almost too much.
Yeah.
What are we going to talk about on this show?
Yeah, well, Friday the 13th, a little bit auspicious, but best of luck to all of those lining up for the 122nd Boston Marathon coming up this Monday, April 16th at 9:32. The elite women will start at 10 o'clock. The elite men will start. Of course, thousands of others will start who are sub-elites or not so elites. Best of luck to everyone. Really exciting. On Sunday, April 22nd, we've got the London Marathon, but this Boston Marathon, this has got the American fields that are most likely to produce a winner or certainly podium finishes. So we'll get into that. And Greg, I'll be asking you for your predictions, who you're going to be plunking a few pounds on. And I also will mention another marathon that's happening on April 29th. I'll leave you in suspense on what that marathon will be, Greg. But first, I want to dive right to your interview. Now, Greg, you have been trying to break three. You had some wonderful training in January. We stopped recording this, and now nobody knows what happened. Well, something happened. Perhaps for inspiration, you spoke with a gentleman who has a few years on you and set a PR and achieved Cloud 259, indeed Cloud 257. He got under 3 hours. Greg, tell us a little bit about the gentleman you interviewed who will be towing the line in Boston and trying to set a record at Boston for an age group.
Yeah, it is truly inspirational. He ran 257. He's the fastest 70-year-old ever in the marathon. So he ran a 257 at Rotterdam Marathon the same day I ran Paris, which we'll get to. I ran much, much slower. But yeah, Gene proves that we could be doing this show for another 21 years, Brent. I'm 49, so we've got some time. We've got some time to work on my goal.
You've bought yourself some time.
No, he was fantastic. So I really would love to go right into it because not only was he inspirational, but he was contrary on many fronts. Has a lot of different ways of thinking than many runners on terms of training, stretching. We'll get into it.
Yeah, to break three at any age is a great accomplishment in running, and to break three for the first time when you're 70 is just unthinkable. So let's roll the tape. I'm eager to hear this.
Well, joining us from his home in Ballachinwood, just outside of Philadelphia, is new world record holder Gene Dykes, who just set a world record for 70-year-olds with a 2:57.43 at Rotterdam Marathon just a few days ago. And he set a 7-minute personal best in the process. He's the second human being ever to run sub-3 at age 70 or over, joining the late great Ed Whitlock, who did it at age 73 and 74. Gene, thanks for joining us. What an amazing, fantastic, smashing accomplishment. Congratulations and welcome to Cloud 259.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an amazing journey getting to this point.
I'm sure it has, and we can't wait to hear about it. First, before we get to Rotterdam itself, which we will very soon, I want our listeners to get a sense of you, Gene, and your enthusiasm for running. You just told me you're headed up to Boston in a few days to run the Boston Marathon on Monday. So that's two marathons in 8 days. So I have a few questions. One, are you nuts? Two, how are you feeling? And three, what are your goals for Boston?
I think most people would agree, yes, I am nuts. But if I have a superpower, it's the ability to recover quickly. I mean, I've not only done marathons week after week, but I've done two marathons in a weekend several times and won my age group on both days. So, I'm used to running with little rest. So that's why I'm feeling confident going into Boston.
So you're feeling a little bit sore? You must be sore, right, after running that fast?
Yeah, I was walking a little slowly yesterday. It's starting to get better today. My coach has me doing just walking tomorrow as well. Thursday, Friday, and Sunday, I'll just do some easy miles before the race on Monday.
And what are you planning for Boston? Are you going to make another run at your new world record?
No, I don't think I'm that certifiably insane. The last three times I've run Boston, I've had the exact same time, 3:09. So I'll probably shoot for that to make it four in a row. The two primary goals are to win my age group for the third year in a row, and the age 70 to 74, no, well, I guess it's 70 plus at Boston. The age 70 plus course record is something like 3:16, and I hope to beat that handily.
So what do you attribute your ability to recover so fast? Is it just luck of your physiology, or is there some way that you approach running that enables you to do it?
Well, there are two things. I think there must be something, since I seem to be kind of far out on the curve on that. But as with a lot of things, it basically comes down to training. The fitter you are, the faster you recover. So the best way to, you know, to recover is to do hard runs day after day. I'd guess, for instance, stage races are wonderful training for that. You know, every day you're going out there and running quite a few miles. You get a night's sleep, and you go out and do it again. And besides having a blast, it teaches your body to be able to do well on a day-to-day basis.
So the other thing I found amazing is you run ultra marathons. You ran three 200-mile races last year. Is that correct?
Yes. It was called the Triple Crown of 200s. Candace Burt, the race director, has three of them. And, I'm like a lot of people. I sit there before ultra sign up and start pressing enter buttons, and before you know it, you're entered in way too many things. But those were all incredible, incredible races, and a little slower than my Rotterdam pace. I would say the average pace over the entire race, believe it or not, is like 30 minutes per mile. And I'd say my moving pace was averaging about 20 minutes per mile. So it hardly qualifies as running, even though time and distance just take on whole new meanings when you do 200. You feel like you're really ripping it. You look at your watch, it says 16 minutes per mile, and you just can't believe it.
Well, I just can't believe how many miles you're able to put on. I mean, A, just completely aside, it's just amazing that you're able to run that much. Do you know how many miles you ran, let's say, last year?
Yeah, I kind of added them up. The last 2 years, each year I ran, about 2,800 miles. And maybe the more interesting thing is that of those, 1,300 miles each year were races. So 1,300 miles of races and just a little more than that training. I love races.
Yeah, you love it. You enjoy it. But you also, I guess, that becomes sort of part of your training as well.
Yeah. For instance, in ultras, I tell people I'm not an ultra runner. I'm a marathon runner. All my training is geared exclusively for marathons, and the ultras help me build base for that. They're a lot of fun. I could probably be better at ultras if I trained specifically for them, but that's not really my goal.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you do, in addition to the races and all these miles, do you do speed sessions? Do you run on a track? Do you run with a team? Can you tell us a little bit about your everyday running in Philly there?
I do whatever my coach tells me to do, because he knows better than I do what I can do and what it takes me to get me to, you know, accomplish the things that I have. And he really mixes it up. It's not one of these programs that you could just write down and spread it out to the masses. Each day is different. Each week is different. Yeah, certainly each week there's some mileage. It'll be marathon pace or faster. And there, you know, usually one long run, but sometimes I have to write what he wants me to do down, because it's so complicated. You know, 3 miles warm up, and then 2 miles alternating between a couple paces, and that keeps you on your toes.
And who's your coach?
His name is John Goldthorpe. He has a website called fixyourrun.com, and finding him, you know, basically changed my whole life. Just totally totally changed it.
How long ago was that?
That was about 5 years ago. I ran my first marathon 12 years ago, and I was getting better each year, and after 5 or 6 years, it looked like I was beginning to plateau. And I went into the Toronto Marathon hoping to beat my personal record, which was then 3:16 at the Steamtown Marathon. And I totally bombed out. It was 3:29. I finished something like third in my age group. And I said, maybe I should just give it one more shot and hire a coach. And within 5 months, he dropped my marathon time from that 3:29 to 3:09 at Boston. And I've continued to improve every year since then. It's incredible what he's done.
Well, I'll say it's incredible. I think most people would think someone of your ability and speed at your age would have been, a 2:30 marathoner a few decades ago, but you weren't running. Or did you run earlier at a young age?
Well, a brief history is that I ran track in high school, and it's kind of a big cheese. I was able to do the 2 mile in a decent time. Then I went to college, and I was totally blown off the track. I mean, I was getting lapped, something awful in 2 mile races, and so for the whole rest of my adult life, I was firmly convinced that I was just a mediocre runner. I would jog sometimes and get into decent shape, but it never occurred to me to race. And then, about 12 years ago, I guess you could say I fell in with a bad crowd. They encouraged me to try a race, and at my very first road race, I qualified for the New York Marathon without having to go through the lottery. And at New York, I qualified for the Boston Marathon. And so I kind of got thrown into it all of a sudden and, realized, hey, I like this. And for an old guy, I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. So, back then, I had no imagining that I would be where I am today. I mean, just 5 years ago, 3 years ago was when I first conceived the notion that, hey, if I can continue improving for 3 more years, I'll have shots at things like what I did at Rotterdam.
So let's talk about Rotterdam. Mm-hmm. You went in with a goal of breaking the record, which was 3 hours and some...
23 seconds.
How much of a chance did you give yourself of breaking the record, let's say?
Well, they say trust your training. And I knew from my training that I ought to be able to do it. But when your fastest marathon is 3:04 and you're trying to break 3 hours... it tends to instill a little doubt in you, no matter what. And especially because, normally I'll kind of keep things cool, but somehow I managed to tell everybody in the world that I was trying to break this record. And people were just, giving me all kinds of encouragement and letters. And my daughter found a newspaper at Rotterdam, and they ran a front page article saying this guy's going to go out and break the world record. And basically, they're just taking my word for it. And so, I had a lot of fear going into it. But race day comes and you do what you're trained for. And, I settled into a pace and you pray nothing goes wrong. And nothing did. In fact, I ran a nice negative split race. I really pounded out the last 2.5 miles. Believe it or not, it was, of all my PR marathons, I've probably PR'd 8 or 9 times. This was by far the easiest marathon I've ever run.
So there was no wall.
Yeah. I mean, because, it's a truism that all runners, especially beginning runners, should know. I mean, there's nothing worse than the pain of just starting out. You're out of shape. It just feels awful. And I think a lot of potential runners quit because they think, hey, if I run faster, it's going to be even worse. And it's the exact opposite is true, because the more you train, the faster you get and the easier it gets. I mean, really, I went out, my training runs were way worse than actually running the marathon, because in a training run, you're running when you're tired. And when you run the marathon, you're running completely rested and you're running exactly what you're able to do and no faster.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you talked about your splits. I'm looking at your splits on Strava. And by the way, I think we owe a massive thanks to your daughter for getting your race up on Strava.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was pretty clueless about that. I mean, I get them on when I get home on my desktop, but she figured out how to do, you know, out there with my phone.
Yeah. So this is a work of art. You averaged a 6:43 mile or thereabouts, but you had no miles of 7 minutes or slower and no miles under 6:35 until, as you say, the last 2 miles, 25 and 26, which were 6:27 and 6:25, and then you had a 5:50 pace for the finishing stretch. So that is just, as I said, a work of art, Gene. How did it feel like the last stretch there?
Oh, I was smiling a lot because, yeah, I knew it was in the bag, and I was feeling great. And I had no idea I was going that fast. You know, I just felt like, oh, I'll just, you know, run a little stronger. And, you know, you see the finish line in the distance. And the most amazing thing happened at the finish line. For the first time in 100 races, I remembered to turn my watch off when the race ended. So that's why there's only 5 extra seconds on the Strava time.
I encourage all of our listeners to go on Strava and to follow you. I think because you don't have many runs up there, you've only got something like 50 followers, but I bet you that's going to be multiplied 10 times over in a week or so. You're probably getting a lot of attention. So how have things changed? Have you gotten a lot of calls since you've been back? It's only been a couple of days.
Boy, and just keeping up with the Facebook posts is a full-time job the last couple of days, and emails. There are a couple other people waiting in line to get some interviews. So
yeah, give them about a week or two. No,
okay, I'll try and stall them.
No, you should talk to as many people as you can. You're a legend. I wanted to get back a little bit to your training. So you talked about your coach. Do you do all your running by yourself, or who pushes you when you really need a solid effort when you're not racing?
I'd say I run about half my miles alone and about half my miles with a couple training partners who are close friends here in Philadelphia. I run with them at least 2 or 3 times a week. If people are looking for motivation to get out, I mean, there's nothing better than knowing you're meeting a friend. It makes you just jump right out of bed where you might want to hit the snooze alarm otherwise. Mm-hmm. And Julie Deary and Ken Height, they're just the greatest training partners all through the time I've known them. You know, sometimes I've been the better runner, sometimes they've been the better runner. And of course, when you're training, you can always figure out a way to do a good training session that you both can do. Although we try and stay as close to my coach's recommendations as possible. But every once in a while, if I'm out for a social run, I'll look at my workout and say, screw that. I just want to go out and get, like, for instance, I have a running group every Saturday morning. And, about 20 or 30 people get together and go out. And, you know, I try as much as possible to get out with them, which means I have to modify my Saturday workout to kind of include that. Sometimes the workout is too tough and I can't. But nothing's written in stone.
So what made the difference what got you from 304 to 257? What did you and your coach do differently this cycle compared to others? Or was it just continued improvement experience with a similar program?
I don't think we did really anything different. Just, my pace limits, creeped down as I kind of went from one level of fitness to another. During those 3 years, my ultra running, went from crazy to insane. So I kind of think at first I thought, well, maybe I can be good at marathoning despite ultra running. But now I'm beginning to think, since I'm having such great results for instance, this training cycle. I mean, while training for Rotterdam, I ran a 100-mile trail race in Texas in February. That's not what most people do training for, a PR marathon. But, it works for me, so I do it.
We were just talking on our last episode about over-distance training. Some elite runners will do a 29-mile training run, a 30-mile training run, but 100 miles, that's the whole other ballgame.
Yeah, and for instance, last year, the week before Boston, I ran a 100K trail race and still won my age group a week later. So, no, distance running, the kind of running that you're not running full bore and over a shorter distance, I guess that might, if I ran maybe a 5K the day before a marathon, maybe that would be worse than running a 100K a week before.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you do to avoid injuries, or again, is it just a gift?
Well, I've had a few injuries. I'd say 4 or 5 that put me out for more than a month. Each time I thought I was totally washed up, but I've always come back stronger. I guess the main thing I did to avoid injury was stop stretching. I mean, some bodies just aren't made to be stretched. And so I never stretch.
You never stretch?
I never cross train. Nothing. I just run.
You don't do any lifting or other calisthenics? You just run?
Nope. Mm-mm.
Well, that's interesting.
No special diet, except for a seafood diet. You put it in front of me, and if I see it, I eat it. So,
wow, that's... So you just run.
Yeah, there's a lot of conventional wisdom out there that I don't think much of, and stretching is certainly one of them.
What other conventional wisdom are you not a fan of?
Oh, a lot of people, it seems like, attempt to do calorie replacement and electrolyte replacement. In a marathon, you've got, your body has all the reserves it ever needs for that race. You don't need electrolytes. And longer races, you're going to an aid station, and you got, yet some people, you know, pump these electrolytes like candy during a race. I don't use them at all. Well, I used to use them, didn't use them for a few races, saw absolutely no difference. Realized that the need for electrolytes is pretty much promo from the people who sell them. And food, runners eat way too much food. For the Rotterdam, you know, I had dinner the night before, of course. I tried to eat lightly. I had an energy bar 4 hours, and during the race, I consumed only 200 calories. I mean, that's it. If you haven't got it stored in your body by the time you hit the start line, you know, it's too late to get it any other way. And by training hungry, I never eat breakfast before I run, and I never take food with me when I run. And I'm absolutely certain this teaches my body to store additional glycogen and to burn fat efficiently. So whereas I see other people's, I mean, I haven't seen people post, what can I eat during a 5K race so that I don't hit the wall? You just have to shake your head in amazement.
So the 200 calories that you had at Rotterdam, were was it gels or was it, what did you
eat? I used Hammer Heed. I had 2 bottles of it.
So it was a sports drink, essentially, no
yeah.
Gels, no food.
Right.
Okay.
Right, no gels, no food, a sports drink. And my special secret, it's a little bit of a pain, but for every race, I have to go out the night before after scoping out the landscape on Google Maps, and I find a place about 6 miles from the finish where I can store a bottle of Coke half diluted with water. And boy, with 6 miles to go, it's just such a pleasure to grab that bottle from some bush along the side of the road and put it, you know, Coke is just, I mean, it quells any nausea you might get. It's a hit of caffeine, sugar, wonderful stuff.
You do the Coke thing for trail runs and marathons? Did you do that at Rotterdam?
Just about all marathons, yeah. I'll hide a Coke bottle out on the course. Ultras, oh, I live on Coke. You know, one of my bottles is always filled with it.
Wow.
I get most of my calories from Coke during an ultra.
Diluted with water, but with the bubbles still going, or you flattened?
Well, I wish, but you can't. I mean, if I didn't shake them out, they would shake themselves out and splurt all over me. So, no, I have to get rid of the carbonation. I'd rather it was in there, but
well, that's we've uncovered some real interesting tips. I think we have to try out. I often don't eat much of anything before a marathon. I used to stuff myself with a bunch of bagels and a yogurt and a banana, and I found that it really tired me out earlier because your body has to spend energy to digest.
Absolutely. Any blood that isn't going to your muscles is blood that's not helping you run your best race, which of course is why you try and stay cool because, you know, with water, you know, sponges and so on, because that reduces the need for blood to go to your skin. So if you can keep blood from going to your skin and from your stomach, that's all available to your muscles. And you have to do everything you can to maximize that.
Mm, great stuff. We need to get you a sponsorship deal with Coke.
I don't think I'm their demographic.
Well, speaking of sponsorships, you probably don't have a sneaker deal, but I'm wondering what kind of running shoes you wear, or does it vary?
Oh, I've got all kinds of different shoes, you know, much to my wife's dismay. But for Rotterdam, I wore the Nike Vaporfly 4%. They were, you know, they cost like $300, but man, mm-hmm. are they incredible shoes. Mm-hmm. You hold them in your hand and you can barely feel them. They're so light, but you put them on and the cushioning feels like they're 6 inches thick. An amazing shoe. I will only wear them for races that I feel like, you know, is a really important race. I would never train in them or just run some ordinary marathon in them. But boy, if you want to get the most out of your race, I've worn them four or five times now. I've had a personal record in that distance every time with these shoes.
Wow.
It's not all attributed to that, but I think it's a significant factor. But other than that, I seem to have a lot of, you know, New Balance, Brooks, Mizuno. I mean, I'm not wedded to any shoe. I'm pretty lucky that way. A lot of people in ultras just get blisters at the drop of a hat. I almost never get blisters, and I don't have to break in shoes. Just put them on and head out.
So I just want to touch on your goals beyond Boston. You said you never expected to be where you are a few years ago. I wonder if you give thought to what you want to do from here on in. One question, though, is did you ever meet or race against Ed Whitlock, or is he someone whose accomplishments you looked closely at?
I did meet Ed Whitlock at that Toronto race where he gave a little speech, and a friend of mine knew him, so we posed for a picture together. He talked about some of his records, and he says, of all my records, he says, the one I feel most confident of is my 70 to 74 age group record of 2:54.48. And I'm 3 minutes off that now. I probably will try and give that a go. Little did he know that when he said that, the guy that had a chance to beat it was in the room. I knew it even less than he did, I think, because I was still just a mediocre runner then.
Well, that's amazing. I think he would appreciate having someone give it a go.
Uh-huh.
So I guess you'll be scouting out fast courses maybe for the fall, or do you already know what you're running later this year?
Oh, I usually make my calendar up for the entire next year in November. This year it took me until February or so to flesh it out, and I still have a couple question marks. But since I just entered a new age group, the priority goes to races where I can set a U.S. record or become national champion at a distance. I've got a spreadsheet now where I have all those races listed, what my goals are, who has the record, and what my pace will have to be to beat it, and so on.
So are you prepared to announce on our show that you'll be running Chicago?
Well, that's actually a question mark. I'll have to get together with my coach because, during the summer I do this crazy stuff. Chicago is just, I might be able to train up for Chicago, but, I'll be doing something like a 200-mile race, 6 weeks before that, maybe 8 weeks, and I'll have to see. And I have a vacation in the middle of September, where I suppose I could run, but, that'll take dedication to get up and finish running before 7 in the morning so that I can join the group. So my list right now, I'm looking at 10 national championships, 17 U.S. age group records, and 2 world age records for this year.
Those are all separate races. So that's...
Yeah. Some of them would be at the same time, like a national championship but age group record.
But you're planning on racing how many more times this year, roughly?
Oh, I usually run 30 to 35 races a year.
Wow,
I really hate empty weekends on my calendar. I'll look and see no race, and I'll look around. What can I do that weekend?
One quick question, Gene. So are you retired at this point? And tell us what...
I retired about 5 years ago, just about the time I picked up my coach.
And what was your career?
I was a computer programmer. Loved every minute of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
That's great. So we have one final question we ask all of our guests. You've already given us an enormous amount of tips, many of them contrarian, which I loved. But if you had one single tip to help others cross the 3-hour barrier, like you just did, namely me or anybody else, or really any barrier, let's say 4 hours, 5 hours, whatever barrier. We have a lot of serious runners at every ability. What would be one training tip or psychological tip or any other tip that you would give them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the tip I would give probably doesn't apply to, you know, world-class elite runners, you know, I'm talking about the young studs. But for everybody else, all you have to do is each year plan on doing something a little more ambitious than the year before. Just run a little further, train to run a PR at some distance, and every year just do a little more, and heck, before you know it, I mean, you're doing things that, you know, you would have thought impossible, and that's always been my thing. What can I do this year that outdoes last year? Planning the following year, boy, there's nothing more fun than that.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. I like it. It's kind of like a metaphor for the marathon, right? The key to running in a marathon is to focus on the mile that you're in and not to look too far ahead. So don't, you know, but you're saying, yeah, focus on this year, get a little bit better each year, get a little bit more aggressive or ambitious, as you say. That's a great, great tip. Thank you, Gene.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pleasure having you on, and we look forward to your future accomplishments. Congratulations again to you and to your coach and your family and all your running partners. And we'll be rooting for you, Gene. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye now.
You know, Brent, one other fun fact that I forgot to throw into the interview. Gene won his age category at Rotterdam. And, you know, Rotterdam is a big deal race. It's a gold label race. It's got a big field, lots of serious runners. Gene won his age category by 45 minutes. And he would have, of course, easily won the age 65 and age 60. So he trounced everyone within 10 years of him in that marathon.
Wow. I mean, 45 minutes is a long time. But then you think about it, age 70. Wow. Mm. Well, I really enjoyed that interview, Greg. A few things popped out at me. First off, he seems remarkably grounded. The counterintuitive stuff you were talking about, I guess the no stretching, running on a, you know, he believes that runners eat too much food in marathons, which to him are sort of short races, given that he does some ultras, right? Mm-hmm. That he uses the ultras to train for marathons is interesting. You know, I've always thought people did the opposite. You know, they may run a marathon to train for an ultra, but to use an ultra to train for a marathon is sort of interesting. And it seemed that he had three tips that you could use to break three. So the first tip, it seemed to me, was to retire. The second tip, perhaps, to get a coach. And the third tip, to get the Vaporflies. So you do those three things, and I think we'll get you under three for this fall.
I think I'm in.
I think Paul Ryan just retired, and I think he's younger than you, Greg.
And he ran a 250, didn't he?
So that was his first misstep, wasn't it? When he claimed that he broke three. No,
and,
no, no.
And
no.
We will never forget it. Runners will never forget it.
Runners won't.
Never
or did he say? Floyd. Did he say that he would run a three? He ran a 302 and actually ran a 402. I don't know. It was.
I think he said 250-ish, and it was actually a four or something.
All right, something. He lied. Anyways, he got his marathon time wrong by an hour. Oopsie poopsie. Too bad. So sad. So anyways, I really enjoyed that interview. And I think that if I had to criticize, but it seemed that with his counterintuitive thoughts or training, and he seemed to not kind of get why runners do certain things like fuel up so much during a marathon. First off, if you're running sub three and you're 70, I think that your system of processing is different from most people's, right? So mm-hmm. His ability to burn fat on a marathon because he trains on an empty stomach, I mean, that's very remarkable, and I don't think it's highly usual. I have, I believe many other runners would have a hard time doing significant training on an empty stomach. So I'd say that he's an outlier in his performance. And so perhaps the approach that he uses works for him. I'm not certain it would work for many others or, you know, the average runner. But certainly it is useful to hear these different approaches and to understand that, you know, what works for the average runner might not be the thing that works for an individual runner, for you or me or for certain other people whose bodies operate differently.
Yeah, you know, with anything about science, like we know that some of the things we hold dear about marathoning and we accept as true are going to be proven false, like some of them, right? We just don't know what. That's true of any era. You know, I think about this with all the stuff I was doing to get through an injury. I was foam rolling. I was doing stretching. I was going to this specialist. Some of it might be very, very helpful. Some of it might be bunk. We may discover foam rolling doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like the fact that he questions everything. He may not be right, and it may just be for him. You're absolutely right. I mean, I wouldn't be able to run as many miles as him. I would break down. I'm already breaking down running less than him. So you're absolutely right. It's an individual thing, but I like the fact that he questions everything.
Yeah, and he certainly has found what works for him. And I don't doubt that, you know, eating less in a marathon does work for him, and eating more in a marathon, I'm certain, would not work for him. You know, I don't think he's come to these conclusions, you know, haphazardly. So finding what works for you and questioning, and maybe trying different, combinations, is a good way to go about it.
The thing I love about Gene is he kind of embodies something that's true of the marathon in general for many, many runners. It's this thing of undiscovered talent. He didn't have any idea what he was capable of 5-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a good runner a little bit when he was younger, but he just had no idea. And that's a little bit true of some of the elites. I mean, Desi Linden didn't have a big pedigree before she started challenging for top finishes at these major marathons. Some like Galen Rupp, you know, were sort of brought along as prodigies from, from an early age, but others, look at Jordan Hasse, even, you know, a great runner. We didn't have any idea that she was this good at the marathon. She may have, but the rest of us, she really was she's become a much, much better marathoner than a track runner.
Yeah. I mean, she was a child prodigy herself, but not in, it seemed like, her progress had stalled on the track. And so to see, it's interesting to see her excel at the marathon, because her greatness from high school sort of returned at the very long distance. And I think it also, you know, because she was so good so young, I think that makes you believe, you know, she could improve even more in the marathon. That potential is almost unlimited. And I agree. And that's partly what makes Gene's Dykes' story special. You know, when I had heard that you had interviewed someone who was 70 who ran sub-3, I was amazed, but my jaw really dropped the floor when I learned that it was his PR. Ed Whitlock had run plenty faster, in younger years, I think, than when he got up into the 70s and 80s. So, I mean, that should give some runners hope. And it's wonderful that how runners can discover this sport later in life and have many years of improvement.
Indeed. Yep.
So Gene's goal at Boston, Greg, he mentioned, it seemed like, for him, the 3:16 goal to get the record for his age group was sort of low-hanging fruit. He mentioned getting 3:09. He'll be running this, just 1 week after Rotterdam, was it?
Yep.
So, yeah, that's a quick turnaround. So that's, you know, that gives us one more runner to track and to cheer for. Looking at the elites competing for the win, it hasn't been since 1985 that an American woman has won the Boston Marathon, but there are four of them: Shalane Flanagan, Molly Huddle, Jordan Hasse, and Desi Linden, who all are, I'd say, have better than 50-to-1 shots. I'd say maybe Linden is the long shot of the four. Hasse, Huddle, and Flanagan. One could make very strong arguments for those three, and you can certainly make a dark horse argument for Linden. Greg, how do you see it playing out with those four? And I'll give you one international runner that to represent sort of the field that they'll be running up against, and that's Edna Kiplagat, the defending champion. Kiplagat is 38, Flanagan's 36, Linden's 34, Huddle's 33, and Hasse is 26.
Yeah, I would say overall there's a probability, I would say, that an American woman wins, which is amazing since it hasn't happened in so long. How to pick? I don't know. I think you're selling Desi a little short. Yes, she probably Let's Run put it very well. She probably doesn't have the fastest, you know, upside. Like, she's the least likely to ever break 220. But on this course, you know, she came really close to winning this race a number of years ago. She was down on Boylston Street paddling for the win.
Yeah, 2011, I believe, yeah.
But, yeah, I think the others probably have a higher chance. I think Molly Huddle's got an outstanding chance. It's like she had a great debut at New York, and then we almost forgot about her in the marathon a little bit with Jordan Hasse making so much noise, and then, of course, Shalane winning New York. Molly Huddle's just, to me, just has the focus. I mean, just even her personality just seems to fit the marathon. She just seems to be a grinder, and she's I just can see her running that last 10K of Boston, which is basically downhill from the top of Heartbreak Hill. I can see her pulling away in that last 10K. She's a 10K runner.
Yeah, I think she's nuts. I've interviewed her.
Not like Gene Dykes, a different kind of nuts.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think she's kind of nuts in a way that works really well for a professional distance runner. I think she's extraordinarily focused and extraordinarily competitive.
Relentless.
Relentless, yeah. I think I spoke with James Chu, our track guy, earlier today. I think he's got Molly. He suspects she might win, or she will win. You could easily make a case for her. I'd say the one thing that, you know, I'm cheering for Desi, to be clear. I like the long shots. I like the dark horses. And I think that one thing that may be playing into Desi's favor is the weather is supposed to be kind of crazy. So there's supposed to be, I think, rain, maybe thunderstorms, and a big headwind. That's the forecast now. A lot could change between now and Monday. But I think that the weirder the weather, the better it is for Linden. Because I would see if any of the runners, I don't think any of the runners would fear strange weather, but I think she would most embrace it and kind of really enjoy it. And if there's any sort of competitive moves made, or sort of, I could see Flanagan and Huddle, for example, getting locked into a battle side by side, pushing the pace. If the pace gets too hot, you know that Linden will be there to pick up the pieces.
That's right.
If she's in grade A shape. And one thing that's sort of difficult to one reason this is difficult to handicap now is we don't know how good shape Linden's in. Molly Huddle's coach said that Huddle could run a sub 220 on a flat course right now. Reports are that Flanagan is in great shape and Hasse is probably in great shape, though she had a bit of a hiccup missing a half marathon that she was entered to the world half marathon she didn't run. But I believe that Salazar has said that, you know, she's fine right now. Huddle beat Hasse in a few races leading up to this. But Linden, we don't know. I mean, she ran a half marathon and not a too impressive time recently in New York, but she never kills the half marathon before the marathon. So,
yeah, every other race she does, she's done 10Ks, half marathon. She's never challenging for the win, and she may be laying off a bit, or that's just not her. She's the longer the better for her, but she's never a factor in half marathons or 10Ks.
So I'll say if experience really helps on this course, then I think that's an advantage for Flanagan and Linden most of all, but the disadvantage to Huddle. Both experience at 26.2, she's the least experienced at that, but also on this course, this strange course that goes down and up and down.
So I'll put more pressure on you, Brent. Pick the order of the four Americans.
Yeah.
That's really tough.
Jeez. You know, I've had weeks to think about this, and I look at the four names and I have no clue. So I'll just go with what I want to happen, and that would be Linden for the win, Flanagan in second, Huddle in third, and Hasse in fourth. What do I think is going to happen? I think Hasse takes it, Huddle in second, Flanagan in third, and Linden in fourth.
So I would just flip Flanagan and Hasse. I don't think Flanagan's going to want to lose to Hasse. I think there's a rivalry.
It doesn't
there.
Matter what you want. They all want to beat each other.
We'll see. It'll be very interesting. It is more or less a toss-up, but it's fun to throw out some predictions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, on the men's side, we have Galen Rupp, of course, Jeffrey Karui, who beat Rupp last year. Rupp was second at Boston. Also, Tommy Rautola, who is a great Ethiopian runner, has run 204 in the marathon. And some champions from Boston from prior years, Lalisa Desisa and Lemmy Berhanu. You know, it's Rupp has looked fantastic in training. He ran a 59-minute half marathon. Karui beat him last year. He was sort of a nobody, and then last year he certainly became a somebody by beating Rupp. So here, Greg, I'm going to take Tola, Karui, and Rupp in that order, and Berhanu in fourth.
Is that what you predict and what you want?
No, that's what I want. What do I predict? All right, let's get real about this. I predict Rupp to win. Karui second, Tola third, and Berhanu fourth.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I would agree with that. You know, it's interesting. On Let's Run, they have this. They have a poll, and the most interesting question that I saw on their poll was, "Are you rooting for Galen Rupp to win the men's race?" Yes or no? What do you think? What do you think that the?
I saw that question, but I did not click the answer, so I don't know what the percentages were.
56% said yes, they are, and 44% said no, they aren't. I thought with all the noise on Let's Run and just generally that more people would be rooting against him.
Yeah, I don't root against Rupp as much as I root against Salazar.
Right.
But I'll tell you who it's easy to root for, and that's Desi Linden. And not only that, Greg, but Ben True. And did you know, gosh, I want to do a commercial for this, that there is a coffee called Linden and True Coffee?
And they are not involved with it?
They are. No, this is, they are. Yeah, so there's a good interview with Ben True on Sidious Mag podcast. So we'll put a link to that and on our show links. And one thing I learned from that interview, and we interviewed True a while ago, but we never got around to talking coffee. So he geeks out on coffee a little bit. And so I was looking at Desi Linden's Twitter, and there's a picture of her with a hat that says Linden and True, and it's coffee. And I guess her husband and Ben True are geeking out on coffee, and the spouses are also interested in coffee. So there is a Linden and True coffee.
Wow.
So you can go sign up. Look up Linden and True Coffee, and there wasn't a very clear way to order it, but they will be giving out free coffee, I think, after the Boston Marathon or in the days that follow, the next day at least. So, yeah, no, so my theory on why Desi Linden's going to win Sunday or on Monday, and that Ben True will win this weekend because he's running in the 5K against, among others, Eric Jenkins. On Saturday, the BAA 5K, is they're kind of geeking out on coffee and worried about coffee. And the others are all doing media tours, and Shalane's doing ads for Nike, and Molly Huddle's coach is prepping completely emotionally and mentally prepared her to win this thing. So if there's a hiccup during the race, maybe that'll be more jarring than it should be. You know, so maybe Desi's just going into this like, hey, you know, nothing to lose, whatever. If her training's been going great, the weather's horrible, weird day, go Desi.
I wonder, is the coffee organic? No chemicals? Is it clean?
Definitely clean organic. Definitely organic. Okay, we got a little sidetracked there. So anyways, Greg, one more race I want to mention before we talk about your Paris race, and that is on Sunday, April 29th, so a week after London. On the 29th, Greg, do you know what marathon is on Sunday, April 29th?
Let me guess. I don't know, but Eugene?
Ah, you got it. You got it. Uh-huh. So I was talking to James today, and so Nick Simmons is trying to break 3, right?
Yep.
And my sister's trying to break 4. So wouldn't it be interesting if we put sort of an over-under on this? Their goals are 1 hour apart.
Mm-hmm.
So the bet is, does my sister come within an hour of Nick Simmons?
Brent, I can't bet against
of
that.
Course.
I'm putting all my money.
Yeah, of course. We're not going to bet against my sister.
I'm putting the house on Polly.
Absolutely. She did a 20-mile run over the weekend. I haven't spoken with her recently, but it seems like her training's doing great. She's not in New York City anymore. She's in Madison, Wisconsin. And apparently it's flatter there. But she's getting a lot of miles in. And I imagine it must be – when she first moved there, it wasn't snowing. But I imagine by now she's seen some snow. Okay, moving on. Greg, your race.
Yep.
Your training was going great in January. We were discussing it. You were doing workouts like 20 by 400. You had an 80-mile week. I think in the last time we recorded, we were a little bit worried about a slight injury that was developing and offering maybe a little bit of caution about doing a mile race and then a half marathon and then a full marathon, the Jerusalem Marathon, which originally you were going to do within, what, like 4-day span or something like that.
Yep.
But you did you were cautious. You bailed on that first marathon, to protect, the injury. So bring us up to date. What happened between the half that you did run in 1:28 and then the start line at the Paris Marathon?
Right. So yes, the big half in London, that was the race, the 1:28 and, 13 miles. It hurt for like the last 12. But I mean, I was happy with the time. It was just, I have this, I had this battle with the IT band on the outside of the leg, and it was causing pain on the outside around the knee area.
Okay, which knee? Right knee or left knee?
Left knee, and okay. Bursitis. So big, big ball of goo inside my knee, swelling, causing quite intense pain on the outside of the knee.
So you had the doctors look at this, right, and tell you?
I did. I bailed on Jerusalem because I knew that if I did that, it would just get worse and worse and worse, and then I would be really threatening Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So I bailed on Jerusalem and went to the doc, and they actually did an ultrasound on my knee. I was thinking, are they going to find a baby in there? That's what I associate with ultrasounds. They didn't find a baby, but they did find the bursitis. And the doctor said, don't run. That's what doctors tend to say. Yeah. Don't run. Give it some rest, and then come back, and we may give you a cortisone shot, which I did get. So that was about 3 weeks or so ago before Paris Marathon. And that helped a bit, but I still couldn't run long runs. So it was really two problems. And so I was really cutting back my miles. I couldn't really do a long run. And after about 3 or 4 miles of any run, it would start to be painful. So I was faced with a dilemma, as any runner is heading into a marathon. Do you rest? Do you just completely not run?
Uh-huh.
But what about my fitness? So on, so on. So I really scaled back, and actually it was getting a little bit better. I managed to squeak in a 14 miler. So the longest long run I had in the 2 months leading into Paris was that 14 miler. I had the half marathon, but no long runs, no 20 miles, nothing of quality, because it was just hurting too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just deciding, I just decided to sort of try to just get through the run and not really focus on the time, just enjoy it. Try not to, damage myself. The thing with IT bands though, is it's not structural. So it's basically just a pain and swelling. It's not really going to jeopardize my whole running future.
Okay.
So I did whatever I could to get through the race. And I think from that perspective, I'm pretty happy. I took 4 days off before the race, not running a step.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get to the start feeling okay. And really, should we get into the race? I didn't really feel that much pain until mile 24. I felt great.
Yeah, let's get into the race in 1 second. I just want to sort of clarify one thing. So in January, when you were really hitting it with your 80-mile weeks and everything, I was thinking, okay, this is a new fitness for Greg. Were you thinking, I mean, you had this marked as the goal of breaking three. Now, emotionally, how did you get from that point to getting to the start line and thinking, okay, we'll just see how this goes? I mean, was there ever sort of like a big disappointment in there? Was there ever a day when you're like, okay, this isn't, I'm going to shift my mindset now? Because I think for a lot of runners, it's very tough to let go of the dream goal.
Yeah, it was a bit gradual, I suppose. It wasn't like one moment, but it was just gradually occurring to me that I wasn't going to, because I need, you know, I don't have a whole lot of margin for error, Brent. If I'm going to break three, it's not going to be by a ton. I need everything to go right. And,
yeah.
And just not being able to do, and you had said before my Budapest run, you know, as I was training for that, you said, you know, you got to get in those really quality long runs with, you know, 10 miles at marathon pace, at least, if not more. And I just, not being able to do that, I knew there's just no way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that I think your experience helped you out here. And I was relieved in the, you know, we haven't been that much in touch, but in the brief sort of check-in we had before your race, I was glad to hear your goal wasn't to break three at that point. And I think it's important for runners to be realistic. It's like, you know, particularly at our age, there can be surprisingly good results, but generally the results correlate a lot with the training. And when there are significant injuries before marathons, don't expect to run a PR.
Yep.
And I'm glad that you weren't expecting that. And I think that it's great that, you know, you were able to approach the race with that sort of, let's see what happens mindset. Now, I looked at the splits of at Gene Dykes' marathon. You had complimented him on his running, and he had a six handle in every single mile. You know, the slowest mile was 6:59. So I think he did a nice job of keeping everything under seven. And indeed, they're remarkably even and effective splits, with the last 2 miles being the quickest. And I looked at your splits, Greg, and you did a similar thing to him for the first 20 miles, though all of your miles were seven something or the other. And then something happened at mile 21. Well, what happened at mile 21?
I don't remember what happened at mile 21.
There was one mile in there that was a 10-minute mile, and maybe that was just the Garmin thing. Oh, sorry. So 21, you went to 8 minutes, but yeah, mile 24, I guess, was the 10-minute mile. Did you have to stop because your leg was hurting, or was there a bathroom break, or was it a Garmin malfunction?
No, my leg locked up. I mean, it really was painful. I felt almost no pain at all until just before that mile. It was starting to get sore, but it was like almost out of the blue. It wasn't a surprise, because I've been dealing with this for a while, but I felt great from mile 4 to 22. I felt great. I was really enjoying it. I was looking around, and it was a beautiful day in Paris. It was sunny, arguably too warm for a marathon, but I didn't care, because I wasn't really gunning it. I wasn't redlining it. But yeah, all of a sudden the knee swelled up and I basically couldn't bend my left leg. So I had to walk. I mean, it was just like, there was no other way. I just had to walk in that mile 24. And I was actually worried that I'd have to walk it in from there, which would have been, you know, 3 miles of walking would add like 45 minutes. So I was worried, oh God.
But that was a 10-minute mile walk. That's a pretty good walk.
Well, no, it wasn't. I was probably, you know, running for half the mile and had to walk the second half.
Yeah.
So no one can walk a 10-minute mile, I don't think. Well, race walkers can. Yeah, they actually do. Race walkers.
They walk 6-minute miles. But no, really, I mean, it's sort of an interesting point, because late in a race, like, people who do this a lot, every once in a while, they're going to have a race where they're just going to bonk completely. But, you know, you're bleeding a lot of minutes late in a race. And I guess my point is, you didn't bleed that badly. There's far worse to bleed.
Yeah. And somehow, I mean, the fact that I was able to run again was a surprise. Like, I mean, I jogged eight something miles. I walked a little bit and just collected myself. The swelling came down maybe a little bit somehow, and I was able to bend my leg.
Okay. So I'm glad to see that you haven't run since. At least your Strava says you haven't run since. I would recommend, before even hearing what you're going to say, taking at least 2, maybe 3 weeks off completely. I don't think that you've had a total break from running in a while, but I want to hear your mindset about running. It's a loaded question, just given that you poured, from my perspective, it seems, you've poured your heart and soul into it for 9 months or so now, and you had this sort of disappointing last month given the injury, though the marathon did go well given your reset expectations.
Yeah, I'm still optimistic, Brent.
Awesome.
Sorry, I'm still optimistic.
No, I'm very glad to hear it. You know, it's, douse me with your optimism. I want to hear it.
Well, you could say 3:27. That's more than a minute per mile I need to get faster from Paris, and that's a lot. That's a ton. But it felt just so easy running. You know, some of those miles were in the sort of 7:20 range, so that's maybe closer. It's more like 30 seconds a mile behind 3 hour pace, which is 6:52, a number burned on my brain. And I didn't bonk, by the way. I felt perfectly fine otherwise, except I just couldn't, my knee hurt and I couldn't bend it. I wasn't sore in any other part of my body the next day. I was limping on that left leg. So, I mean, the only doubt is, you know, I just need to get this knee healthy so I can put in the training for my next marathon. That's the only question mark. I feel optimistic about it. We've interviewed all these wonderful runners. They've given us outstanding tips. We know what to do, Brent. I know what to do. And I still feel confident that if I have a good training block, I can do it.
Are you going to join me in the New York City Marathon?
Can you get me in?
Can't you get in, Brent, being from over there?
I'll pull some strings. We'll work it out.
All right.
We'll work it out. We're running New York together. We'll find a way. I'm running Berlin before that, by the way, end of September.
Can we, okay. All right. Well, that'll be your tune-up.
No. Berlin is the fast course, Brent. That's the world record course. That's the 2:59 course for me. So if I don't do it there, and if I don't do it with you inspiring me on the streets of New York, then my plan is to hire a plane to take me up to 26 miles and to drop me out of it without a parachute.
Okay. Now look, back to the three tips from Gene Dykes that are going to get you there. Okay, retire. I don't suspect you're going to retire that soon, but just know that that's an option. Two, yep. Get a coach. Now this I think is worth taking seriously. I think it sounds like you found a training group over there, the Harriers, is that right?
That's right.
Cambridge Harriers. Yeah. That has some people who are pretty devoted to the marathon. And that to me seemed a breakthrough in your training. Have you considered firing me and getting another coach? Someone who's closer to you and who may give you more oversight.
Well, I think I have many coaches, but maybe I need to have one, you know, focused, devoted coach who's more attentive than you, Brent.
I could be far more attentive, but here's the thing. You need to feel accountable to the coach. And I think it's easier to feel accountable to someone who's not your friend. With me, you could make an excuse. But what if, say, you hired that gentleman that Gene Dykes said changed his life, right? So his running life, this John Goldthorpe, or somebody else, you know?
Yeah.
Just a suggestion.
A great idea. We have a great coach with the Harriers, by the way, Ron Allison. I don't think I've necessarily tapped into him as much as I could. Have him lay out plans. He formulates workouts. He gives some of the quick runners in our group instructions for their long runs. So
yeah, I think on these club teams, it's interesting. You know, we have a coach, Tony Ruiz, here also for our road workouts. And I think that a lot can be gained, a lot of insight, and we actually got some of Tony's insight on a prior episode. But coaches for these groups, they're coaching many athletes. And, you know, sometimes a lot of those athletes are a lot faster than we are. So I do think that getting a coach that is laser focused on you, perhaps in addition to your Harriers coach, or maybe getting more attention from your Harriers coach, demanding more attention is a good way to do it, may help. Yeah, or maybe just tell me that I got to do a better job. Now, finally, the Vaporfly. Now, have you thought about this?
I think about it a lot. I'm not sure why I'm so reticent. I just
like
don't want to do it. I mean,
it?
I don't particularly like Nike and what it represents.
Yeah.
But hey, if given the choice of not doing it and doing it with these shoes.
What surprises me is that I think that the people who wear them, they don't seem to be thinking twice about it, and they don't seem to be unethical people.
No. Not at all.
They
not
didn't,
at all.
You know, Gene Dykes didn't seem to have any qualms about using them. He was quite happy about using them, it seems. So,
but what happens, Brent, if I get the shoes and I run a 2:59? I'll be delighted, ecstatic. But then they say, yeah, we're gonna ban these.
I know. Then you've got that. Well, I don't think they'll ever be banned. I Yeah, I don't think that that's where the money's at, banning them. I do think that, you know, Ross Tucker may protest, or he has already protested. May the sports scientists of the world may make a bigger claim. I think the question is, will other shoe companies follow suit? And this mm-hmm. may even be a conversation topic after the Boston Marathon, where you've got Linden and Huddle, who won't be wearing those, and Hassay and Flanagan, who will be wearing them, based on their mm-hmm. sponsor. You can't really fake that shoe. I don't think you can wear a Brooks shoe that's that's a big marshmallow. You know, so you're wearing them or you're not. I don't know.
We'll see. I still think about it.
Well, I'm psyched to hear that you're still psyched, Greg. Now, on my advice on taking some time off, are you planning any time off?
I had exactly the same thought. Take at least 2 weeks off, no running whatsoever. I'm really tempted, though, Brent. I really enjoy our little work lunch runs.
Yeah.
Group lunch runs. It's a slow pace. So they're on Friday. That's today. So do I have permission, Coach Brent, to do a little lunch run with
nope.
the group?
Nope. See, Greg, you got to understand that it may strengthen the group to not have you there once or twice, because it puts other people in positions of responsibility and authority. And, you know, every once in a while, it's important to miss a meeting.
You know, I had a different injury, as you remember, two or 3 years ago. I had the sacral back stress fracture.
Yes, and that's actually what's knocked Ritz out, right? Is that right?
Something similar. He has the SI joint. It's in the same area, but it's slightly different. But I actually did one lunch run with the group on a scooter. I don't know if I told you that.
You're allowed to do that, or a Segway. Get yourself a Segway.
All right.
How nerdy is that? See if you can keep up with him on your Segway.
I couldn't keep up with them on the scooter. I was getting dropped because I don't know how to do a scooter. It's not as easy as it looks. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm just a dork.
That's great. That's great that your head's still in the game. Now you got to get my head in the game. I'll say I've got the Brooklyn half coming up, so I'm, as always, looking to ramp up my training a bit. But for inspiration, I went to the Southwest, Greg, and I really like the Arizona State Sun Devils logo, their little, what do you call it? Not a logo, but what, icon?
Yep.
So I went there, and as it turns out, that's where Desi Linden went to college, mm-hmm. and also mm-hmm. Shelby Houlihan. So some really good runners have come out of Arizona State. So did some running in Phoenix, and it's hot there, Greg, but when you run, of course, in 90 degrees coming from snowstorm hit New York City, it's not the heat that you notice. It's the dryness that gets to you immediately. Mm. Like within half a mile, you're just so incredibly thirsty. And, you know, it feels like someone's got a hairdryer on full blast right in your mouth. So that was fun. That was really fun. It was nice to trying to stretch myself out to 6 miles in the desert.
Speaking of inspiration, here is a Cloud 258, Bren, and someone whose name is Steve Sharp, who was on the verge for so long, and he actually had two 301s last year. In one of them was in Manchester, which is my personal best, and we ran there together against the Marathon Talk guys. He had a 301 there last year. He had another 301. He did it at Manchester just this past weekend. The same, he had even written a poem about breaking three called "An Impossible Dream," which we don't have time to get to. But it's not impossible because Steve did it. And congrats, big congrats to Steve for breaking through. And I also want to mention, or just to give a good luck to my training partner Elad Jalasko, who has been much more injured than I have been. Mm-hmm. He's actually running Boston. He's made a miraculous recovery in just the last week or two. He's in Boston right now, and he's going to do the same thing where he's just going to take the pressure off, not run for time, and just try to soak up the Boston experience, the Wellesley Wall, Boylston Street, all that. And he promises me that he'll pull out. Elad, pull out if you're hurt. But he's done an 8 miler and a 10 miler pain-free, so he's just basically going to run Boston.
Oh,
I hope
good.
He gets through it well. Yep. Good luck, Elad.
And I'm sure you told him not to get in the medical van if he does pull
That's right.
out.
I told him it's a long way to the finish.
Yeah.
From the tent. Go the other way and hop on the tee.
Yeah. Good luck, Elad. That's great. A few other odds and ends, Greg, just in the world of track. Alicia Prott-Lear, who James and I saw at Millrose this year, win a thrilling 3,000-meter race that had a lot of changes up front. This was a huge upset at the meet. She's generally a steeplechaser, so she had some great 3,000-meter and 1,500-meter runs during the indoor season, and then she went at the Commonwealth Games. The Jamaican actually beat the Kenyans in the steeplechase, which was a big surprise. She won the gold in the steeplechase. And this prompted Asbel Kiprop, the great Kenyan miler, to tweet, if it was possible for Jamaica to win steeplechase, then dreams are valid for Kenya to ever win 100 meter. So we'll see if the Kenyans can now take on the Jamaicans in the flip the script.
Yeah, that was Commonwealth Games is all over the place here in London. It's on the BBC, and that was a great race. She was actually quite a bit. She had dropped off in the last lap and then battled back and won. It was an exciting race. If anyone wants to find it online, I recommend it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I will. I saw the result. I didn't actually see the race, but what a result for Alicia Prott-Lear. And I know the Lears are close to the Willises, and Nick Willis, if you're out there listening somewhere, when I get my training back, when I get fit again, I will rejoin your group and try to do a better session. Stick to all of the training guidelines next time.
And listen to your coach.
And listen to my coach, exactly. Listen to your coach, everybody. Listen to your coach. All right, for Greg Lemelstein, this is Brent Jones. We will be back sooner for our next episode than we were for this episode. Took a long time this time, Greg. And Greg, you mentioned before the show, and I'll just mention it now, there's a nice healthy competition between a few other running podcasts. House of Run has done 430 episodes. Marathon Talk has done 431 episodes. And they both get out there just about every week. Greg, we've done 63. That's 3 times 21. 21K is a half marathon. So we're 1.5 marathons into this.
You geek.
We'll see you next time.
I don't think we're going to catch those guys.
No, hey, slow but steady. We'll see you next time on Cloud 259. Good luck at Boston, everybody.
Of Boston's famous party, you have read it in history. Now we're gonna give you the latest lowdown about a score of fellas who went on a spree. There were 20 men, hardy looking Yankees, dressed in feathers the Indian way. They were out to show coming generations how to throw a party up in Boston Bay. Now on that boat there was a lot of tea, and in spite of all the stories you've read about, they also had 10 little bottles. What they did with them, nothing's been said about. Then they threw the stuff deep into the ocean, and a lot of it sure was tea. Those colonials really had a notion how to throw a party that made history.